You know, one of the things I think about a lot is what knowledge really is, kind of how it works. You see, I always feel like there's a difference between knowledge that you have intellectually and knowledge that you've learned from experience. Now, most people would call this the distinction between knowledge and wisdom. And they're kind of different, and they're kind of two parts of the same thing. And as we begin to move forward with perhaps an end to lockdowns and distance learning requirements, we can pretty easily reflect on how we might have intellectually known that teachers or students or teachers and students are going to respond to challenges and changes differently. After all, everyone learns differently. And one bit of knowledge or wisdom that we might be picking up now are the opportunities inherent in new ways of learning, including distance learning, or at the very least, an understanding of how different populations of students are going to respond to different ways of delivering knowledge. After all, something like a pandemic affects everyone, but it affects some people disproportionately. So while some solutions may work for most, they won't work for all. We know that, after all, in education, it's very rarely one size fits all. All of this is especially informative when we think about students with learning differences or learning disabilities. And we're talking about very common issues in learning, like dyslexia or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. And one group that thinks about this kind of issue quite a lot is the National Center for Learning Disabilities. You may remember them from previous episodes and their Director of Policy and Advocacy, Megan Whitaker. Well, they've teamed up with Understood.org to put out some new research that could powerfully impact your teaching when it comes to students with these learning differences. So, this week, Megan Whitaker from NCLD rejoins the club as our guest speaker to introduce the Distance Learning Toolkit, what they describe as key practices to support students who learn differently. And it truly is a toolkit. It includes things teachers need to keep in mind, key teaching practices, ways of doing assessments, and other resources. So, if that sounds intriguing to you, then this is the episode for you. Keep listening, because we're talking about distance learning and learning disabilities, and it all starts right now. Hey everyone, welcome back to another meeting of the EdTech Club, the podcast from TCEA. I'm Andrew Rausch. This week, we're reflecting on the changes we've seen in education, specifically how they affect students with learning differences and disabilities, and specifically the kinds of ideas and mindsets educators can take into the future when working with these students, especially at a distance. So let's get into it. Here's our conversation about all these topics with Megan Whitaker.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me today. My name is Megan Whitaker. I am the Director of Policy and Advocacy at the National Center for Learning Disabilities. And NCLD is a national nonprofit organization created more than 40 years ago by parents who had a child with learning disabilities. They really struggled to find the right resources for their child and wanted to make it their mission that others wouldn't have to experience those same challenges. So today, our mission is to improve the lives of children and adults who have learning and attention issues through policy, research, and young adult leadership and advocacy work.
Yeah, and thinking about the research, your organization's obviously been doing a lot of research on the needs of learners with learning disabilities, and also the best ways, the best practices and tools, et cetera, to make that learning happen. Of course, all of that knowledge and understanding has to get used differently when the whole world changes like it has in the last year. And so many educators and students are making a pivot to distance learning. I know that y'all helped put together a distance learning toolkit to help teachers who are teaching at a distance working with students with learning disabilities. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. And, you know, when we talk about learning and attention issues, we're talking about students who have learning disabilities like dyslexia, a disability in reading or other types of disabilities in math, writing, as well as students who have ADHD or other attention or processing difficulties. And we know that when you can effectively reach and teach these students, you can really likely serve all students. And so we have set out to make sure that we are providing the right services and supports to those students and that educators have the skills that they need to effectively reach those students in the classroom. And so before we get into the distance learning toolkit, there's kind of some foundational research that we have done that it has become the basis for the newest toolkit that we've created. And it, you know, it kind of brings me back to thinking about where we are as a system and how we've been serving students with learning and attention issues for a long time. Even before COVID, our system faced a lot of challenges in effectively serving students who learn differently. And there's a lot of data that I could point to show this. But one piece of data I always go back to is that even though we know by definition students with learning differences have at least average or above average intelligence, right? There's nothing suggesting that they can't achieve at the same high levels as their peers. We know that on the NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, it's a test given every 2 years, more than 96% of students with learning disabilities are below proficient in reading and math. And that's kind of a shocking statistic when we think about it. And that's only one data point. And we see this ripple effect into other areas, right? When we're not reaching and teaching these students, the problems really multiply. We see that they're three times as likely to drop out of school. They enroll in college and complete college at a much lower rate than their peers. They're twice as likely to be unemployed. And so there's just a lot of kind of ripple effects and outcomes that we need to be thinking about that really reinforce the need for us to be supporting them. And we also know that 70% of students with learning disabilities and ADHD spend 80% of their day in general education classrooms. So general educators really play an important role in supporting them and improving those outcomes. And so we began our research actually a couple of years ago wanting to answer a few key questions. What do educators know and believe about these students? What do they need to know and believe about these students? And how can we help build those mindsets and skills in general educators to effectively instruct them? So that's where we really began. And you can see all of the research that we've done on our website. We put out a report called Forward Together, Helping Educators Unlock the Power of Students Who Learn Differently. And that's at ncld.org/forwardtogether. And I'm happy to share some of the findings of that work that have led us to a set of mindsets and practices that are evidence-based that we know need to be implemented in order to serve these students pre and post-COVID.
I can't help but wonder, I mean, you define these learning differences and attention disorders and the kinds of things like dyslexia or ADHD that might fall in this category. Now, I think people kind of understand that because those students make up a group within the larger group of learners, it might be harder to resource or understand the mindsets or tools or techniques that can reach and help mitigate, as you pointed out, that statistical difference we really do see. These students aren't any less capable of learning, but the system might be less capable of teaching them. So as we look at that, then how many students are we talking? I mean, if we're talking about attention disorders and learning disabilities like dyslexia, this might seems like it would be a pretty sizable amount of the population in general.
Yeah, so we've estimated it's about 1 in 5 students that have either identified or unidentified challenges with learning or attention. But we also say that what works for the 1 in 5 actually works for all 5. So if you're not always teaching to your average learners, but you're teaching to those who are struggling the most, everybody's boat is going to rise in that situation. And so that's why we really encourage the use of these evidence-based practices. We found that a big part of this was actually about teachers' self-efficacy and what they believed about themselves and how confident they were in their skills. And so where teachers, we heard that most teachers feel unprepared to teach the 1 in 5 students. We've heard that they still have a lot of misunderstandings about students with disabilities. And even though research has proven and debunked a lot of myths, they still kind of don't understand the science behind these brain-based issues. But the important thing is teachers really want to improve. Teachers want to do better. They want to know more. And so it's really important that we get these evidence-based practices into their hands. We get these positive mindsets into the way that they teach so that we really can effectively serve not just the 1 in 5, but all students and really create an environment where all students can thrive.
And so before we get into the details of how distance learning can affect this and how we can use the right tools and mindsets in that regard, take us through that basic intersection of the research you had, the information and data you had, and how you transferred that into this idea of the kind of mindset an educator needs to take into their teaching.
Yeah, so you know, we did a lot of focus group work and survey work to understand the mindsets, and we found that by and large, teachers feel unprepared to teach students with learning disabilities. Even though 2/3 of them said that they had taken professional development courses on students with disabilities, trial and error was how they learned to teach these 1 in 5 students. We found that even though they really want to improve, they feel overwhelmed and unsupported. They really don't have the professional development and feedback and mentoring loops that they really need. And one of the discouraging findings is really that 50% felt strongly that students with disabilities could achieve at grade level standards. Only 50%, which means the other half of teachers don't think these students can achieve at grade level standards. So if we're sending kids into classrooms where the adults around them don't believe they can succeed, we're not really going to give them the opportunities to show that they can. And so we really need to work on the inclusion mindsets. And ensure that we're lifting the number of teachers who believe that inclusion benefits those with disabilities and those without disabilities, because the research has proved that it does. Only 30% of teachers felt that they could be successful when they tried their best. And so if we know that teachers who believe in their own abilities to be successful tend to have more positive beliefs about inclusion, all of these mindsets are really tied together. So we combined what we heard from teachers about the way they were feeling and how they were approaching their teaching, and we looked at the literature. We did a scan of over 150 empirical articles to say, what are the evidence-based strategies and instructional practices that are tied to increased outcomes for students with disabilities? You might call them high-leverage practices. And so we pulled out the 3 mindsets that we think are really important and the 8 practices that we know have an evidence base behind them. And we created the report called Forward Together. And also we created a school leader guide to really help begin to implement these mindsets and cultivate them within teachers in a school building. So the 3 mindsets that we pulled out were a positive orientation toward inclusion. The second is a strong sense of self-efficacy. And the third is a growth mindset, both that teachers can improve and that students can improve their performance as well. Teachers need to believe that students can and should be learning alongside their peers who don't have learning challenges. Teachers need to believe that they actually can reach and teach these students in an inclusive setting. And they need to believe that they can grow and improve through practice and hard work, both teachers and students. And then there were the 8 practices, which, you know, as I said earlier, don't just benefit the 1 in 5 students with learning disabilities, but also all learners. And these are things like explicit and targeted instruction in a particular, you know, subject area, universal design for learning, strategy instruction, where we're actually helping to teach students how to learn, the cognitive and metacognitive strategies for learning, positive behavior strategies, flexible grouping, right? There's a whole list of these practices that we know can work when implemented in an inclusive classroom for students.
It's interesting that you start with this question of individual mindset. I mean, obviously from that data you discussed, the teachers obviously feel like maybe they're simply not supported enough. And I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say that many teachers feel like they're maybe under-resourced. So part of it is there are problems within the educational system that make educators feel like maybe they can't operate as effectively as they might want to, but that can negatively impact their mindset then. And that mindset, you know, feeling like the possibilities are limited means that when you go out to act, to behave, to carry out your job, and you start bringing in tools and practices, it's going to kind of cap your potential if you don't have those kind of mindsets. Am I reading that correctly?
Absolutely. And I think we can point to a lot of factors that have gotten us here, right? Teacher preparation programs may not include the right courses and the right practical experience for educators. Class size is going to be too large for teachers to potentially effectively reach all students. Funding of schools, right? All of these things are going to affect the resources at the disposal of educators. But what we did find is that teachers with a positive mindset came into the classroom saying, this is my job. All of these students are my responsibility. Just because I have a student with an IEP doesn't mean I leave them to the special educator to figure things out, right? I really embrace this, and I know that I've got to reach them where they are, and it may not be perfect, but they kind of embraced that responsibility and set out to really serve that student as best they could. And I think that that positive mindset is certainly a key factor here so that they can then seek out these additional strategies and resources and begin to implement them. And our, you know, our toolkits really help them. We kind of go through reflection questions to help them understand, where am I doing these things? Where am I not doing these things? And really self-reflect on, at what points in my day can I approach things differently so that it's not just this ideal mindset that you're trying to do, but really a practical steps you can take each day in small ways to try to incorporate those mindsets.
And the question of the mindset, you know, having a positive sense of inclusion and having that growth mindset that we hear a lot about, those kinds of things, they factor into the actual techniques and teaching tools and things like, you know, keeping ways of tracking students with disabilities. So how do you think of that intersection between the mindset and the practice? If I'm an individual educator, how do I see that flow going so that I can boost up my sense that, one, I can do it, two, the students can do it, and three, we can do even more in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the more teachers believe in their own abilities, the more likely they are to try new things, to kind of, you know, we saw that they often use trial and error. So if you believe that that you can reach these students, you might be more likely to kind of seek out new ideas and try things in the classroom that haven't been tried before. And if your students see you really embracing this and being positive about what is possible, they're going to also believe more in themselves. And so I think that there's kind of a ripple effect there between the teachers and the students. If you believe students can grow and learn, you'll be more likely to push them to reach high standards. You'll give them new opportunities to show what they know. And then all of these evidence-based practices can help you do that, right? If you want to help students reach new levels and you start using universal design for learning, you may uncover that there was an approach that hadn't been used with the student before, but they can demonstrate mastery in a way that you had never really thought about before. And so really these mindsets and practices have to go hand in hand so that you really do have a full toolbox to begin to allow these mindsets to really live within your practice.
And in the toolkit, you outline some of these practices that can be really useful. As you mentioned, universal design for learning, positive behavior strategies, flexible grouping, and there are many examples in your toolkit. Another thing I'd like to discuss then is what happened. Well, I put that in the past tense, and I could put it hypothetical, but it is real. What happened when we made this almost nationwide transition to distance learning? How does that big structural change to how we deliver education affect these students we're talking about and teachers? And then what are the responses and ideas that came out of that for y'all?
Yeah. And, you know, it would be one thing if we had mastered all of these practices before the pandemic began, right? But reality is we didn't. And so while we know what works, we were still, you know, working to help teachers get it right and do this stuff at large scale. And then the pandemic hit and we basically expected teachers to pivot immediately to an entirely new learning environment. We expected families and students to adapt really quickly. So there's a whole lot of challenges that were thrown out there. I think the largest and most obvious one, of course, is the digital divide, right? None of this matters if kids aren't connected to their schools. A packet of instructional material is not going to be as nearly as beneficial, particularly for kids with learning disabilities, compared to actually having synchronous learning sessions with their teachers. So the digital divide, I think, is the most critical thing that we unfortunately still haven't addressed a year later. We saw that there was not only academic disruption and students not receiving whether it's general or special education services in the same ways, we also saw the social and emotional and relationship kind of disruption. Students, you know, lost out on that daily interaction with peers and with adults. And so you can't ignore the disruptions to their routines and relationships that certainly is going to impact instruction. But we did a focus group not too long ago to understand from teachers themselves, you know, what have these new challenges been? And they said that they really struggled with professional development. They haven't been offered very much during the pandemic. They didn't have a lot of guidance on how to effectively instruct students in this virtual world. And so if you think, you know, about toolkits like these existing for in-person instruction, there was a gap there. There really wasn't anything about how do I do this virtually now? If your district had even pivoted to a learning platform that allowed it, right? So there's accessibility and access issues for kids with disabilities in the virtual space. And teachers also told us that one of their biggest challenges, right, maybe before in the classroom, it was behavior. Now in this virtual environment, it became really about student engagement. How do we maintain student engagement? How do we measure it? What does it look like in this virtual setting? And they talked a lot about the social emotional impacts. And that's not just about the impacts on the students, but also for teachers themselves who might be managing kids at home and balancing all of these different responsibilities and trying to reach out to students and families. So there was a lot of weight on teachers' shoulders to really get things right. And, you know, they just felt like there wasn't a lot of guidance from principals, from administrators during this time about how to do all of these things well. They really wanted more feedback, more coaching from others. And, you know, one bright spot, I think, is that they were able to really lean into family engagement in a new way. And I always want to bring that up because there's certainly a ton of challenges that we're still really grappling with. But what we have seen in many cases is that families became important partners in a new way because of the pandemic. They saw their children learning at home. They had a lot of valuable information to offer to teachers, and they really began to become partners on a more equal playing field with educators to help make decisions and support students. And so, you know, it's just a very different world that we're now teaching children in and that educators have to navigate. And that's really why we created this distance learning toolkit.
Yeah. And in the toolkit, when discussing the application of all these ideas to distance learning, there's a number of specific suggestions worth looking through, and they are all sort of explained why they work and how they work. One thing that jumps out to me, there's a strong emphasis on collaboration, right? Like we're in this environment where our personal professional networks were all there physically when we went to school. Our learners were all there physically when we went to school, and all that infrastructure sort of dissolved overnight. So there's a whole new piece when it comes to collaborating, not just with your coworkers and your colleagues, but with families as well. One of the recommendations is making sure you work with families collaboratively so that they understand the technology you're using and things like that. Can you tell me a little bit about that collaboration piece when it comes to distance learning so that we can serve these students?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, collaboration is incredibly important regardless of setting. It always has been. And when we talk about efficacy, you can really build your self-efficacy when you learn from others. Special educators might have unique skills and expertise that general educators don't, and vice versa. And so working together, regardless of setting, is essential to really reaching all students, whether they have an IEP or not. And so I think when we're in this virtual space and you're not getting that face time and you're not seeing other educators in the halls to really check in and talk about how students are doing, it's important to build that time out now. Where you can, having more than one educator present in a virtual learning space for students so that you can use breakout rooms and small group instruction is really essential. Differentiating learning is harder in virtual spaces, right? You may not be able to be as nimble. And so I think the collaboration here really becomes more important, and making sure that you know, you are also building in time to hear from parents, not just at your yearly IEP meeting, but checking in on a weekly basis to find out how class has been going for that student and how what parents are observing could inform what a teacher might do differently in the next lesson. And so I think that collaboration is incredibly important because you're not as close to students in the same way. You may not be able to observe them in the same way. And so gathering information from as many sources as you can is really essential in this setting, and using that to make kind of decisions together about what a student might need, what might be missing for them, is just really important in distance learning.
I can see how in a world where it may feel like the entire world changes on an hourly basis, and that's for us grown-ups out here in the world, but I can only imagine for students, the situation in their families and in their lives and in their schooling changing on a weekly basis, it only raises the value of that ability to keep those lines of communication open and, as you say, nimble.
Absolutely. And, you know, I can't overemphasize how important the social emotional piece of all of this is. We had a year filled with anxiety and uncertainty from the pandemic, death and loss that the students experienced. It. We also dealt with, you know, racial justice and a lot of change politically and socially in our country. And students feel that. So while we've had this whole conversation about academic instruction, it's really important to acknowledge students may not be fully available and ready to learn academically if we're not also thinking about the social emotional piece of all of this. And so, you know, we're also doing some separate work on that topic and really trying to make sure that schools are thinking proactively about how to welcome students back and how to support them. Because these shifts in routines and I don't want to say trauma, but for some students, it may have been trauma. It has been stress. And while there are some kids who've really done well during this time and may have thrived at home, there are many, many more who I think have been struggling for a variety of reasons. And we need to think about the whole child. We need to think about the family circumstances as well. And the fact that, you know, students have really undergone a really drastic change over the last year.
Yeah, I think a lot of I think pretty much anyone could relate, but I think a lot of educators would probably be able to recognize that sense of going in to do the job on any given day and maybe feeling like there are social or psychological barriers they got to punch through to be able to deliver their work. I can only imagine that that's just as strong, if not stronger, for a lot of students, and particularly students with learning differences who maybe already felt like they were a little bit behind or couldn't keep up or just maybe didn't feel like they fit very well into however learning was happening.
Absolutely. And I think that the most vulnerable students right now are those at the intersection of disability, English learner status, students from low-income backgrounds, students of color. I mean, the experiences that they've had have probably been the most challenging during this time. And before the pandemic, our system was already underserving them and not meeting their needs and not giving them opportunities. And so, you know, the big concern right now is that it is hard to address both the social emotional impact and the instructional loss or academic gains that they need to make. And so it's really important. I think now is a really critical moment to get this right, to be focusing on both academics and, you know, hopefully not widening the opportunity gap that for these students, while we're also trying to ensure that we have wraparound services and are meeting the needs of the whole child. And it's a tall order and there's a lot of work to be done, but it's incredibly important that we don't continue to allow certain groups of students like those with disabilities be invisible or to achieve less because we're not equipped to support them.
And so if I'm an educator and I want to first start by understanding this, and I also want to be able to start pumping up or building strong muscles, brain muscles for these mindsets, you know, I want to be able to know that I have the potential. I want to be able to know that my students have the potential, and I want to increase that potential going forward. What steps should I be taking? What do you recommend at NCLD for educators to do? How do they check out this toolkit and what should they do moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I always think that learning more is the key, right? You can learn about these learning disabilities, these attention issues, and understand more about your students. It's always a great place to start. You can find great resources on understood.org, who is our partner in creating this toolkit. You can find resources on ncld.org as well. And I think that a second thing to do after you really, you know, seek to understand and learn more about your students is to really self-reflect. Understand if there are areas in which you want to improve or where you need to you know, practice and as you said, to kind of build these muscles and these skills. And that's really going to be critical. And so, you know, working through the toolkit, you can really begin to see examples of where you can use these strategies. You can share the toolkit with others and with your leadership team so that it becomes something that everybody is using, talking the same language and, you know, embracing the same kinds of approaches to serve students. Like, you know, one teacher can't do it all. And so making sure that you're sharing what you're learning and doing with others is really important. But I would also just say, generally speaking, in this context of the pandemic, as you're working to inform yourself and to improve your own skills, it's really important that you also reach out to families and don't forget why you do this work. You obviously are here because you care about your students, and making sure that you do partner with families, hear their experiences, what they believe their child needs, and really kind of think big picture about, you know, how do I help my kids in my classroom really achieve given the current circumstances academically, socially, emotionally. You can't do everything, but if all teachers are working to improve their knowledge and understanding and really striving to be inclusive and to provide high quality opportunities for all students, I think together we can get there.
Okay, we are about out of time. Thanks to Megan for joining us and talking us through all of those things this week. And if you love new data and new information and teaching and learning, stuff like this, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast, of course. Tell your friends, rate and review us if you like it, and keep up with TCEA on social media to always get the latest from our Tech Notes blog, from our innovative PD team, and all the events we host at TCEA. And speaking of events, now is the time to register for our Elementary Technology Conference. If you work in pre-K through 5 education, or you know someone who does, you won't have to go through a big list of sessions to figure out which ones are right for you. At the Elementary Technology Conference, every session is just right for elementary educators. Plus, you'll have access to sessions for up to 30 days. You'll have a blast with some of the most fun elementary educators around, and it's all online. Go ahead and check out the details over at elementary.tcea.org. But since I pitched all that stuff to you and I want you to go check it out, in addition to the Distance Learning Toolkit, I'll leave it at that. And so we'll take a break until next week when we'll return for another meeting of the EdTech Club. Until then, I'm Andrew Rausch. Thanks for being part of the club. EdTech Club is a production of TCEA. To learn more and to join, go to tcea.org.